Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
This wasn't going on when I was a kid. It was just a more civil country. And it's become uncivil because everybody's hurting. And the reason they're hurting is because the monetary system's broken. So if we fix the money, we fix the world.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Finance U. I am your host, Dr. Chris Martinson. Today, we're going to be talking with the author of this book, Larry Lepard, and this is The Big Print. And it's an incredible book, but let me cut to the chase because the title of this episode is This Sucker is Going Down. Larry, or Lawrence, he's at Lawrence Lepard on Twitter, and there's the title of his book there, picture there, and investment manager, Equity Management Associates, LLC. They're sound money advocates over there and gold stock fund manager, Austrian economist, anti-federalist, love it, CrossFit athlete, and he's tagging Bitcoin here. Larry, welcome to the program.
Oh, nice
good to
be
see you.
It's a long road that we've gone down since we got to know each other at the beginning of COVID. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I have to confess, I'm a little surprised. I thought this sucker was going to go down earlier, but they've gone to more and more extreme measures. And now, Larry, I feel like I'm almost caught in like a weird movie where it's the title should be Nothing Matters and Anything Goes.
Yeah, it is kind of a Groundhog Day moment. I thought it was going down in 08, shows you how wrong I was. So,
yeah,
you know, they're really good. They're good can kickers. And that quote, as you know, is derived from one of our less than bright presidents, George W. Bush. And the math is unrelenting, though. And there's a chapter in the book called Stein's Law. And, I do believe in Stein's Law. And it's, as others have, compared it to Newtonian physics, where, reaction and counter-reaction. And you just can't add this much debt and, run these big deficits without eventually trashing the currency. And, of course, that's what we're doing.
I'm going to paraphrase it bad, but it's Stein's law is anything that can't go on forever won't.
That's correct. Anything, yeah, if something cannot go on forever, it will end, which is a rather simplistic law and kind of obvious, but as you've just pointed out, I mean, they can go on a lot longer than you think. There's a lot of momentum in the system, and the people who are pulling the levers at the top of the system, many of whom are quite evil, are good at that lever pulling job. They know how to have kept us off balance for a long, long time. You've seen it in medicine. I've seen it in finance. We've all seen it. It's been horrible.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, you had this chart in your book. And I want to have, can you talk us through this? Because the red line on the bottom is our income, national income, such as it is, GDP. Top line is total credit market debt outstanding, TCMDO in the Fed series. That's all debt, state, federal, local, all of it, corporate. Doesn't include liabilities, underfunded pensions, Social Security, none of that. Yeah. This is just straight.
That would add another 100, 150. Yeah, that's just total system-wide debt is over 100 trillion now since the book's been published. It's gone up a bit. And the red line is GDP. And so GDP is the gross domestic product. It's the value added. It's like the income statement. It's what we do every year in terms of, things we buy and build and spend money on. And the GDP has to pay the interest on the blue line. Because debt comes, well, and generally speaking, debt comes with interest, although there have been periods where even that wasn't true when they had ZERP.
Mm-hmm.
And as the interest, if you can see, the slope of those two lines is quite different. And so if the debt line goes up at a faster rate than the underlying growth in the GDP, eventually this is Stein's law. Something's got to give. Either the debt has to fail, we will not be able to pay the interest, or we have to massively inflate the GDP in order to get it up to a more balanced way, a balanced level like we kind of did after World War II. And so it's a conundrum, and but it's mathematical and it's kind of rather certain. But as we just discussed, it's not easy to know the exact timing.
It used to just be a couple of lonely guys like us, right? Going, hey, this is a math problem, right? And I'll note now, Larry, that we got Ray Dalio chiming in, Elon Musk obviously making a big stink about this, even Jamie Dimon saying, hey, whoa.
Yeah.
Those two, the red line and the blue line, can't diverge forever. Jay Powell's talked about it. Like, people are talking about it now.
Yeah.
Do you feel like it's, does this mean we're actually making some progress, or is are they talking their book? What's happening here?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we are making progress. I mean, it's becoming so obvious that these big luminaries can no longer ignore it, and it really is a fundamental problem. What's sadly lacking in most of those guys, although Dalio kind of gets it because he's a gold guy and he's becoming a Bitcoin guy. You know, what's sad, Elon sadly is kind of clueless on the whole Bitcoin thing from what I can tell, and Jamie is anti-Bitcoin. Is that there's nobody really talking about solutions and what do we do with it. And I found it amazing, actually. I think I tweeted about it, how, you know, Jay Powell is out there citing Stein's law. And it's like, okay, dude, well, then why don't you take away the punch bowl, you know? Because he's, you know, the Fed is really the one, the people who made this possible with all the ZERP policies. Now, you know, the first round of ZERP was pre him and it was Bernanke, and he actually pushed back a little on Bernanke. But anyway, long story short, yes, more people are becoming aware of it. And therefore, you know, the conversation of how to protect oneself is more important than ever. Some people seem to get it. I think Dalio is getting it. I think, you know, Paul Tudor Jones, a big hedge fund manager, he completely gets it and says gold and Bitcoin are the two fastest horses in the race. But a lot of other people would prefer to cling to the system. And I don't know where Jay Powell is. I mean, he's citing Stein's law, and yet he doesn't really have much of a solution for it. So there it
well,
is.
Well, I mean, technically, he's just a monetary guy, and he has opined that the fiscal situation's out of control.
Right.
So he can opine on that, but not really his deal. However, that didn't stop our president from opining on Jay's job, saying that he wants to fix both fiscal and monetary policy. He said, I've instructed my people to stop issuing long-term paper, and I'll get Jay out and I'll set interest rates, right? So I thought, again, anything goes, nothing matters.
Yeah.
Larry, I'm old enough to remember when a statement like that would have sent at least a ripple through the markets.
Yeah.
Nothing happened. Bonds didn't, nothing happened.
Yeah, it's stunning, isn't it? Well, you know, certainly nothing's going to happen in the stock market, because I think we're trending towards what the Austrians would call a crack-up boom, which is to say, just the price of everything, you know, going up forever because they're going to print the money to make it go up forever. And that's more or less what happened here. I mean, watching the Trump administration evolve from, you know, we've got Doge and we're going to cut $2 trillion, and then we're going to cut $1 trillion, and now it's down to 150 billion or something, to, you know, and we're going to balance the budget and do all these other things, you know, the 3-3-3 plan of Bessent, to, you know, let her rip, you know, we're going to make it up in growth. I mean, that's a complete 180 pivot from where they were originally. And I think it goes back to the underlying, you know, thesis that you and I spoke about pre-show, which is kind of, given the system and the way it's constructed, you know, Lynn Alden is really right when she says nothing stops this train. They have to keep it going, or else they're looking at a big collapse in everything. And, you know, obviously inflation is bad, but a big collapse is even worse. I mean, we saw the prelude to that in 08, and therefore Paulson begged Pelosi for TARP, you know, and so they're, you know, they learned a lesson. They're not going to let that happen again, is my sense.
Back in the day, Richard Russell said of the Dow Theory letters, yeah, great guy. I only got to meet him once, but it was such a trip of a lifetime. But he said it's inflate or die. Now, that was back then. And inflate or die means, again, nothing stops this train, in Lynn Alden's words. But the point is that whatever metaphor you want, a shark that has to keep swimming to not die, this system has to have more and more and more put into it. But as they do that, Larry, there are consequences to that, and there are really big, giant social consequences, one of which you talked about in your book. I pulled a different chart, but it's this one, which is that the more they do this printy thing, the more the top 1% pulls away from everybody else.
Yeah.
And so you look, the bottom half of the country is not part of the wealth game. They're not tapped into this whole thing. All of, pretty much 100% of the gains are going to the very tippy top, and that's because the Fed prints, the government spends, and these are the people who benefit the most. And it's very unequal, and this is corrosive to any culture or society. Deeply corrosive.
Absolutely, and that's why you see the election result in the New York City primary that you just had. I mean, the young people
are
know they're getting screwed, and they're obviously choosing the terrible or the wrong solution, but they, you know, they're lashing out that this is wrong. They can see it. They know this is happening, and I can see, we can all see it. I mean, we call them quintillionaires, the people at the top who understand inflation and understand the way the monetary system is constructed. They have set this thing up in a fashion where the more inflation they have, the more we grow this machine, the richer they'll get, and it's at the expense of everybody else. And that's all because we don't have sound money, Chris, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a monetary unit that doesn't inflate. When you have a monetary unit that inflates like crazy, and you have some, you know, favored players, I mean, Wall Street, hedge funds, people who can borrow at low interest rates, and then you and I have to borrow at 25% on our credit cards, we're at a massive disadvantage. And that's not what the Constitution of this country was set up to be. It was meant to be, you know, they knew the outcomes wouldn't necessarily be fair because everyone has different sets of talents, but they wanted the system to be fair. And this system is grossly unfair, just grossly. It's tragically unfair, and it's causing so many people in this country to suffer. And therefore, we've got to change. We've got to break the system, rip apart the system, create a new sound money system. And that's why I wrote the book. I mean, I want, you know, and I wrote it, I tried to write it in a way that average people would get it, because it's kind of a sophisticated fraud, you know, and they make you feel like, oh, you're not rich. Well, you're just not working hard enough. Well, no, that's not really the case. You know, the game's stacked against you, average guy. And, and they know it.
Yeah. Well, the book is The Big Print. It's a great book. Why the title?
Well, so as we said, you know, basically, if you look at what's going on here, they have to continue growing credit and money and the money supply in order to support the existing credit, or else it all collapses. And why the title is actually because my book agent had a great, she pulled it out. I used that term in the book, and she said, "Oh, this has got to be the title." And she's right. We've had two big prints. We had one in 2008 where we grew the money supply, you know, $3 trillion. And we had another one in 2020 with COVID where we grew the money supply 40% or $5 trillion. So, you know, and notice that those have gotten bigger. The first one was smaller than the second one, and they're coming more rapidly in my view. And, you know, we're going to have another one, because you cannot continue, back to Stein's law, you cannot continue to grow that debt without growing the underlying money supply. And so at some point in time, you know, in order to avoid the inevitable collapse of all that over, you know, indebtedness that we have, they are going to have to go back to ZERP, go back to QE, et cetera. And the first thing that's going to fail, Chris, is the bond market. I mean, and there was a, I just tweeted out yesterday there, you know, the UK gilt market just took a real spike higher in interest rates, indicating that people see it over there. And, you know, it's amazing to me that our bond market has held together as well as it has, but it has. But we've seen a couple of tests. I mean, in fall of 2023, it went through 5%, and 12 Fed governors quickly came out and said, "Oh no, no, don't worry, we're done raising rates." So, you know, basically, they are going to be forced into printing again, and you know, it's going to be bigger still, and then we're going to have another devastating round of inflation. I mean, I think the reason the book is timely, and I think the reason why more and more people are focusing on, including the luminaries that you spoke about earlier, it's just that you just can't ignore it anymore. Everybody goes to the supermarket to buy food. And I mean, to me, every time I go, it's a horrifying experience. I just can't believe what a basket of food costs. I just can't believe it. And yeah, and I know it's going up more than 2 or 3% a year, you know, so.
Well, and also there's home insurance and auto insurance. Home insurance, which you have to have in order to have a mortgage in most cases, and also auto insurance, which you have to have in order to drive on the road. You know, because you can't, your car registration will be yanked otherwise. They've those spiked extraordinarily. No explanation, Larry. Yeah. I think, personal guess, they're up to their eyeballs in commercial mortgage-backed disasters, and they're having to make it up by just gouging us on the revenue side, but I'm not positive.
You're one of the first people to say that. I completely agree. I think all those insurance companies hold a bunch of commercial real estate that's they're getting tanked on. They also hold a lot of bonds. And just, you know, generally speaking, long-term bonds. And, you know, look at what's happened to the long bond market in the last 5 years. And so they're losing money on all their investments. And their only choice to, you know, to cover those losses is to jack our rates. I mean, as you mentioned pre-show, you know, a young driver that you're familiar with, you know, what's she paying? $4,500 for, you know, to enter the auto, you know, market?
Yep. Just to drive 1 year, $4,500, little over $4,500. And has ticked all the boxes for safety, you know, driver's ed, this, that, no accidents, all that, right? So that's the best rate you can get in Georgia right now. And by the way, the insurance agent leaned over to my friend and said, "Just be thankful she's not a boy. It would be even worse."
Even worse. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, look, the problem is very obvious to a lot of people. What is not so obvious, again, the reason I wrote the book, is that the monetary system's what's broken. I mean, you know, what inspired me to write the book is I was watching Team Blue and Team Red argue last year, and I watched the debate, you know, between these candidates, and nobody was talking about the monetary system. Nobody was talking about the debt. Nobody was talking about M2. None of that. So it's just not even discussed. And, Yeah, I mean, and then look, I mean, it's the same old, same old. I mean, this big, beautiful bill is coming down right now, and I think it's close to getting passed. And, you know, they basically, what happened to the Freedom Caucus? I mean, these guys caved on everything. You know, you're Thomas Massie, you try and stand up for it, and Trump vilifies you. I mean, it's just, they can't stop this train.
They can't. So I want to put the chart up because you mentioned it. This is M2. M2 is powering to an all-time new high again. So here we are for people looking at home, starting in 1998. It just sort of like keeps growing and growing. M2, this is why we have inflation. It keeps growing. But look at this, because COVID, right? Yeah. This enormous 40% increase in just about a year,
right,
of the money supply. And that's driving why we're having the insurance and the grocery experiences we're having.
Right.
I was surprised to pull this chart up and discover that it just hit an all-time new high. So people are like, oh, stock market's hitting a new high. Bitcoin, gold. These are all actually derivatives to me of this,
yes,
chart, in
correct,
essence. Right? So what's driving this, though? Because the Fed's shrinking its balance sheet. I know that commercial banks are reporting lower loans. Larry, where's the M2 coming from? Do we have to talk about Elon's magic money machines now, or?
Well, I think it must be actually coming out of some of it's coming out of the credit card companies, because you're seeing large credit card growth, and that's just, you know, they can print money, so to speak. I mean, they issue credit,
okay,
give you money to buy something that you don't have, and so that's a growth supply. I do think some of the banks are actually growing. This happens to be the U.S. M2, I believe. If you look global, you'll see that there's a lot of growth in China. Huge growth in China. And so that's pushing global M2 up very sharply, and because they're trying to fight a downturn in their property market. So, it really is credit growth. I mean, Doug Nolan writes a credit bubble bulletin every Saturday morning, which I make a point to read. And he pointed out some of the growth and some of the credit, you know, statistics. And there are just a lot of them that are growing at, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40% a year. I mean, you know, just credit. Credit leads to M2 growth. When you create a new loan and you issue, you know, money against that loan, well, that's more money in the money supply, and obviously the loan's on the balance sheet. But the other thing I think is going on, you know, Bessent and Trump have been talking about the possibility of having a shadow Fed president, you know, appointing the next Fed president because they can't get Powell to resign. And of course, what that person would then say is, hey, just hang on until next May, and, you know, we'll have ZIRP and QE and everything else. And of course, markets are nothing if not forward looking. And so, you know, these markets will say, okay, you know, great. All we got to do is hang on for, you know, 10 months and it's party on, Garth. Well, we can do that. You know, let's borrow and lever up to do it, because we know that everything's going to go a lot higher when all that new money comes into the system in that time frame. So a lot of things going on, but that's kind of my take. And I think, you know, what this implies to me, it's just incredibly bullish for the prices of things that can't be printed. And, you know, the top of that list are Bitcoin, gold, and silver, and then a little further down is real estate. But real estate, I've always said, has a lot of problems because of the taxes and hard to move it and all that kind of stuff. So,
yeah, hey, you might be interested. I just did a big interview with Mitch Vexler. He's out of Texas, and he talks about how the property taxes are a full-on scam. They're a fraud. How properties are appraised, how they just ratchet higher. Of course, it's a tax on an unrealized gain, all of that. But his point was that he had county after county after county in Texas, Oklahoma, every state he's looked in, where there's no mathematical chance that they can pay those bonds back. So they just roll them.
Yeah.
They just roll them. He says it's about a $5.1 trillion time bomb. And of course, that will be the next big print, right? Because it'll have some cool, like, acronym.
Well,
like,
that's the thing. Yeah. They'll try and hide it, and they'll say they're not. I mean, as you know, one point you made earlier, you said, well, the Fed is tightening. Well, yes and no. They're still tightening on the mortgage bond side. But as you'll recall, a few months ago, the $25, you know, billion dollars per month of QT went down to $5. Yeah, so
yeah,
ending as much. And, you know, they're now talking. I mean, you see cracks in the system, right? I mean, there's this thing called the supplementary leverage ratio, the SLR. It determines how much a bank can buy treasury bonds. Well, they're amending that to let the banks buy more of the treasury bonds. I mean, they've got a problem. They've got $9 trillion of short-term debt that they've got to roll over. And, you know, with rates in the 4% range, that's a lot of money. I mean, the interest costs in this government debt we have today is larger than the defense budget. And I think it's getting close to being larger than Social Security. It might already be a touch larger. So, you know, they really need lower interest rates to try and get the budget even close to being, you know, balanced or, you know, out of the situation it's in right now.
Well, so the story has been, and you're exactly right. At first, they came in and said, we're going to shave off, you know, expenses. And then they said, too tough. We're going to grow we're going to grow revenue, right? This is all about, you know, 333. We're going to get the GDP just like screaming higher. So in that first chart we talked about, for everybody listening, what the government is going to do is, instead of attacking the blue line, they're going to attack the red line. They're going to try and make the red line go up faster rather than flatten out the blue line on top. Now, this isn't just government debt. That's everything. Government's only $37 trillion of that. At any rate, that's what they said they were going to be doing. And my concern with that is this. So first up, this just came out on Zero Hedge the other day. But so May was the third worst May on record. So the story is, oh, we've got all these tariffs coming in, more than we thought. We're containing this. We're going to control spending. But I looked at the big, beautiful bill. I agree with Thomas Massie. It just backloads the savings or the cost cuttings to somebody else.
Correct.
But in the near term, we're running the third worst deficit on record. And that's, you know, and it has to compete with 2020 and 2021. The
Correct.
Depths of the COVID craziness.
It's total craziness. And those are the COVID years, which were absolutely terrible. Yeah. So the bottom line is they're stuck. And, they really are stuck. The implications, it's going to run its course, in my opinion. And eventually we're going to have another crisis and they're going to have to do another print.
Another print. So, but then that brings me to this part, you know, chapter 9 in your book. You said sound money is a moral issue. And what I loved was that you put a proverb under that, because I think this really gets to the heart of it. It's almost like we have a biblical warning against what we're about to be doing here. Like, don't do that.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, it's, yeah. Well, go ahead, finish them.
Yeah, Proverbs 20:10, unequal weights and unequal measures are both like an abomination to the Lord.
Yeah.
So what does that mean to you? How do you interpret that?
Well, so this is obviously written thousands of years ago when human beings were trading with one another, and they traded using scales, and they said, okay, you know, how much wheat do you have? I'll weigh it. And obviously back then there were dishonest people, just like there are dishonest people today. And somebody probably created a weight that wasn't actually the true weight and said, hey, I'm giving you what you're paying for in terms of wheat. But in reality, the weight was fixed. And so, you know, the authors of the Bible, you know, recognize that was a form of cheating. And the authors of the Bible were, if nothing else, were, in, you know, believed in fairness, you know, fairness in human relations, fairness in human exchange. And so this is a problem that's, you know, swept down through the millennia. This isn't some recent problem where people try to jigger the money system and take advantage of others. I mean, some humans have been doing this for a long, long, long time. And of course, you can go from then to present and coin clippings and, you know, the Roman denarius, you know, going from all silver to all steel and so on and so forth. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that in monetary matters, the system should be fair. And if it's not fair, it's immoral. And so for the government to dilute, you know, if you work hard, you know, we all have one life. We all have a certain amount of time. That's the one thing that truly is finite for each of us. And so when you spend your efforts and you earn something, it's not an unreasonable request that to have what you earn maintain its value if you choose to save. And in fact, you know, the book also goes through a lot of examples of how savings are what really has driven human progress. Without savings, we don't get capital investment. Without capital investment, we don't get greater efficiency. Without greater efficiency, we don't get the ability to live the way we currently live. And what's really amazing to me, Chris, and the book talks about this, is that these government apparatchiks and Keynesians kind of swiped a system that had worked for thousands of years, which is the gold standard, and declared it to be the enemy, and said it's a barbarous relic. It doesn't do anything good. It does not. I mean, consider that, you know, we built the best country in the world between 1789 and 1946 on the gold standard, more or less. I mean, Roosevelt cheated a little, so did Lincoln. And you know, they've kind of thrown that all in the dust bucket and said, no, that's not real. You know, we really need to have a government managed form of money to, you know, balance out these booms and busts and blah, blah, blah. And you need us, you know, you need us big PhD economists to tell you how to do it. Oh, and by the way, you know, if we're Janet Yellen, we get $7 million in speaking fees, which is really just a bribe, to talk about how to do it. And so, you know, and the world, you know, what's angered me so much is, and I watched it as a gold guy and now as a Bitcoin guy too, is that the world just accepted this lie, like, oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, we're modern. We need to have Keynesian economics. And, you know, there's certain things in life and in the human condition, there's certain timeless principles that go back thousands of years. I mean, thou shalt not kill, you can't murder your neighbor. I mean, it's not like, oh, you know what? We've kind of decided we're not really modern, and there's some people who just aren't really doing it the way we want to do it. We ought to be able to kill them. And, you know, I mean, that, it's like, no,
nope,
that doesn't work, you know, and, you know, and maybe we do it with drugs, right? Which I know you've learned a lot. And so
it's dark, Larry. That's a dark story.
It's a very dark story. But the point is that we left this timeless moral principle of not jiggering with or fiddling with the monetary standard to have a monetary standard that's run by the governments and that gives enormous power to the people who are sitting in those seats where they can control the interest rate. And it's just as simple. I mean, I like to use the example, Judy Shelton points it out a lot, of how, you know, price fixing doesn't work. Russia proved that. You know, you set the price of grain, you're going to get too little or too much. Prices, you know, the invisible hand of economics works really well when you have a free market for prices. Well, money is something that has a price. You know, things today are worth more than things in the future, and the difference in the two is the price of the interest to carry it between that time frame. That interest price should be set by balancing savings against investment demand, full stop. You don't need a 12-board Federal Reserve to sit there and say, oh, we're going to have interest rates at 20%, which almost bankrupted my father, or have interest rates at 0%, which allows contillionaires to get filthy rich at the expense of the rest of us. I mean, it's just, it's absurd. It's just completely absurd. I mean, the Fed, frankly, these huge swings in the price of money, the Fed would have been much better off if they just said, you know what, we're going to set interest rates at 4% and leave them there forever, or 3%, or, you know, just some, I mean, and there would have been ups and downs, but it wouldn't, you know, the extremes that we've got are just nuts. They're absolutely nuts. And this is why we, you know, it's so funny because they were formed in theory to stop the booms and busts. You know, the crash of 1907, where J.P. Morgan kind of saved the New York banking industry, that led to the formation of the Fed. They said, well, we're going to stop that with this Federal Reserve. It's made it worse. It's just made it worse. So,
yeah. No, but back to this. So the moral issue, this enormous 40% increase, this is everybody working and slaving away and starting businesses and taking risks and hiring and firing people and making widgets and doing all kinds of stuff. And then somebody, like you said, sat down and said, hey, you know what we need? We need 40% more dollars in circulation right away. And basically, that stole 40, that, like, if you want to know why people are on fentanyl, quiet lives of despair and death, if you want to know why people are experiencing $4,600, you know, yearly insurance bills now, why people can't get insurance in other areas, if you want to know why groceries are so expensive, if you want to know, all you have to do is look at this chart. That is a moral abomination.
Absolutely. What they did, I mean, imagine you're 60 years old and, you know, they stole 40% of your working life in 2 years. You worked for all those years from, say, when you were 20 to when you were 60. So you spent 40 years of working and you saved up whatever you saved up. And then bingo, 40% of it just got taken away from you. So, yes, that is a moral abomination. Absolutely.
And the thing that makes it really hard, because, you know, I have a registered investment advisory and we work with a gentleman who's very good at helping people plan for retirement. And the number one thing that people can't get their heads around is if you're trying to plan for a world of 3.5% inflation, it's very different than if you're trying to plan for 5%, let alone 7%. Those become almost unworkable numbers, right? It just gets away from you. So can we talk about inflation? Is not like it's always talked about, Larry, in the press. It drives me nuts. They act like it's a comet. We don't know where it came from. It's from the Oort cloud. It's coming through. We don't know. It's a human thing, right? And so what I think most people are not aware of is that for hundreds of years of our country's history, we did not have any inflation. Sure. We had a little inflation in the context of the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, and the Civil War. But it went back down again so that at the beginning and the end of that 200-year period, it was kind of the same prices.
And it's not as though we didn't make a lot of progress as a country. I mean, we went from a nation of farmers to an industrialized nation, and living standards went up 10x. I mean, you know, electricity, I mean, just name all the developments that took place. And it was, yes, with very, very modest inflation. And, and this is, you know, the Keynesians grabbed hold. I mean, they started in 1913. I mean, Keynes was just kind of getting going at that time. They really kicked in 71. I mean, I think the most interesting part of that chart is, you know, if you look at You know, right, exactly.
There, the elbow, the inflection point.
The elbow of the chart, right? I mean, it's just absolutely, you know, crazy. And since then, it's just been a very persistent problem.
Yeah, you say problem, they say feature. They like it this way.
Somebody put on a pod yesterday with a really brilliant guy, and he said, you know, Larry, the system is working exactly as it was designed to work. I mean, and I said, well, you've got a point. I mean, for a certain group of people, it works great. They're wealthy and they're doing well. The problem is the bottom half of the country is getting kicked in the teeth on a regular basis, and they're not doing well. And as you say, fentanyl, I mean, it's horrible. When I think about all the things I saw just on a mini scale, what it did to my family. My family's been very lucky. We were always middle class, so, you know, it's fine. But I saw the pain it's caused in my family, and I know it's worse, you know, in many other families. It's just goddamn wrong. I mean, we just got to fix it. And, you know, again, I mean, I look, Chris, if, you know, when I dream about this book becoming common sense, and you know what common sense was, right? I mean, it was the pamphlet that basically generated the American Revolution. And, you know, Jeff Booth has said to me once, he said, Larry, if we could get everybody in this country to wake up and understand how important sound money is, we could crash this system overnight. And he's right. But you know, as you and I both know, you know, it's taken some time. And we were very lonely voices 5 years, 10 years, you know, when we're listening to Richard Russell, we're getting to be less lonely. In fact, I heard a statistic this morning I thought was really encouraging. A guy went out and he did a big survey. So he has data to support it. 14% of the country now owns Bitcoin. 14% of Americans own Bitcoin. That's a big positive in my view. You know, the tipping point, according to Gladwell, is about 10%. When something gets beyond the 10% level, you get on the steep part of the adoption curve. So, you know, there's signs that people are waking up.
The markets are unraveling and the stakes could not be higher. If you're relying on passive strategies or so-called diversification, or perhaps using an advisor who was, I don't know, maybe in elementary school during the great financial crisis, you could be on a collision course with staggering portfolio losses. Peak Financial Investing is your lifeline. We handpick wealth managers who will actively manage your portfolio with proven market-savvy strategies, not the tired modern portfolio theory that could crumble under pressure. The unprepared will not just lose this time, but lose big. The future that I see consists of both winners and losers, but many more losers this time than last time. Go to peakfinancialinvesting.com today and schedule your free consultation. This is your chance to protect your wealth. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com. And I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, urging you, please, don't wait another day. I started with, this sucker's going down. Larry, is there any possible way for this system to survive, given how it's being operated and who's operating it?
I think it's a very low probability. I don't think it has to devolve into complete collapse or hyperinflation, though. I've often said, and I run an investment fund, and I've often said to my investment fund, you know, to my partners in that fund, if the government were ever to get responsible, this monetary debasement thesis would not be so strong. Now, you know, and most people, when I tell them that, they chuckle because they know the government will never get responsible, but they could. I mean, you know, you've got to think about every possibility, and yes, they could. But I think as a practical matter, Chris, I mean, my prediction of where we go is it gets much worse, the outcry gets much larger, and then I pray that we have people at the top who are smart enough to do a structured monetary reset before we get into complete, you know, hyperinflation collapse, you know, Mad Max kind of shit. You know, I mean, the man.
Yeah.
I don't want to go there. I don't think we have to go there.
Nobody wants to go there. Of course, I do have a farm just in case. Because you got to hedge your bets, right?
Not a bad thing to have on any day. You know, the farms are nice.
Hedge away. So, all right. But as we look forward, I always say collapse is a process, not an event, right? A lot of people think, oh, collapse is going to happen on Tuesday at 9:38. No. It's already happening. And the way I think about this, Larry, is that so Alan Greenspan did this big bailout in 1987, right? Young guy cutting his teeth. Okay. So that was child's play compared to what he had to do in 1994. And they did the sweeps account, big bailout. Most people don't know about it, but gave us the stock bubble boom, internet boom. Then we had a long-term capital management. That was a $5-6 billion bailout. But then we had 2000, And then that was a bigger bailout. And then 2007-08 was a bigger bailout. And then COVID was an even bigger one. So I'm just going to spot the trend here and say, I think this next bailout, each one of those has either doubled or tripled the Fed's balance sheet on average. Okay. So a 2Xer or a 3Xer. So I think the Fed balance sheet goes from, say, 7 to 15 trillion or 20 on this next one.
I have it marked between 15 and 30. Yeah, it could be.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, here's a thought experiment. Let's say they had to go to yield curve control to prevent the bond market from falling apart. And so they said, you know, okay, you don't want these bonds at 3%, or we're taking the bonds, we're going to cap the bond yield at 3%, and if you don't want them, sell them to us. I think the bond market might go to them, sold, you know, turn around and say, okay, Fed, sold to you. Well, there's a $37 trillion bond market. So, you know, add 37 to the existing, it's a little below 7 right now, I think it's 6 point something, but round numbers add 7. So that's a $44 trillion Fed balance sheet, you know, and that's massive inflation. At that point in time, we're not into hyperinflation, but we're kind of looking like a South American country or Turkey. I mean, we have very, very high rates of inflation.
Yeah. Well, and in this process, not an event, the process is underway. Gold started default. So I've been following gold for 25 years, okay? And I have my favorite charts, and some of them are gold inverted against the 10-year yield, right? Or against negative real interest rates, etc. Lock solid, you can just take those to the bank. 2022, they broke, right? And so that's part, this is ongoing. And then we read about, like, you know, central banks buying. And of course, China's doing all this buying of gold. And then we read about somebody stepped up to the plate and bought nearly $11 billion worth back in April of this year, right?
Yeah.
And all of that. So when we add it all up, when we look at year to date, and I also have a year, 1 year one, but this is off of FinViz. Just here's year to date performance. Top of the big green thing at the top is platinum. That was a surprise. Surprise horse coming out of 47%, gold at 23, silver at 22, Bitcoin at 12.5, Swiss franc right under that. But you get, you know, what do I see down there? The bonds are way down at the bottom. But yeah. This starting to smell to me, Larry, like sound money's winning.
It is. And this is only the first 6 months of this year. I mean, if you gold, I think in the last 12 months is up over 50 or 60%, which it very, very rarely does. And as you've pointed out, the divergence between real interest rates and the price of the metal, you know, it's been stunning since 2022. And of course, what triggered that was when we grabbed the Russian reserves.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, so my operating thesis, Chris, and I talk about it in the book, and I think you and I have discussed it before, is that we are in a sovereign debt crisis. And the evidence of that is that gold is at record price highs. Bitcoin is at record price highs. The only piece of it still missing the puzzle is silver, still not, although I think those are coming.
Yeah, we can talk about that in just a second. This is 1 year performance.
Okay.
But
1 year. Good. Yeah. Okay.
1 year. Bitcoin clocking out at 64.8%, gold at 32, platinum 28, silver just 12, laggard. But look at bonds. They're sucking wind down there.
Yeah. And this, you know, because what's going on, as you pointed out earlier, more and more people are waking up to the fact that they can't stop printing. They will have to stop printing. These bonds, you know, you'll be paid back in nominal terms for sure. They'll give you the money. The problem is that the money won't buy as much. And it's quite straightforward. And so, you know, what it suggests to investors, as I say in my book, you know, and I know I have a lot of friends who are boomers who've done extremely well, and they have big stock portfolios, and some have bond portfolios too, although they're moving away from those. But, and I say to them, I say, guys, you know, if you don't have some sound money assets, you're going to get, this is going to be rough for you. Because this decade, in my view, is going to look kind of like the decade of the 70s, perhaps even worse. And in the 70s, stocks went nowhere. And gold and oil, you know, performed extraordinarily well because they were things that couldn't be printed.
Well, as well, I'm a big believer, and more people. I used to be lonely on this too. So I used to trade very, very aggressively. I was a day trader. I was highly familiar with everything. 2007-08, my models, my methods broke, Larry. Yeah. And then I realized a couple years after that I was up against algorithms, and they were remorseless, and their fingers were faster than my fat little finger, right? And I have the proud, I still have it printed out in a file somewhere where I had two gold contracts that just got tagged. I had a trailing stop on them, but it was way below. And somebody came down and reached and picked my two lonely little contracts off at 2 a.m.
Right. And you went right back up to the old price. Yeah.
Yep. They just sniped it and took it out. Right. There's some money down there. Right. Anyway, So it was I learned that it's a little bit manipulated, and of course I think more people are understanding the degree to which it's manipulated, meaning there's players in there who set prices who are setting prices. It's not price discovery. I don't think there's anything more egregious than what's been happening in the silver market, to be honest.
We agree. But
from a long-term standpoint, from a Chartist standpoint, that's the most beautiful cup and handle you could hope for. It looks to me like it's getting ready to rip, but the fundamentals under silver, Larry, we're going to enter our seventh year of a structural silver deficit, less mined than is being consumed.
I know.
How do you have something 7 years in a row and it's basically gone nowhere, really, in pricing?
It's trending up. You know, there's a lot of paper silver out there, as we know, and and there is a fair amount of junk silver. I mean, my coin store, I go there regularly because I'm always buying coins and stuff, and he's got more tea sets sitting around, And you know, it's sad too, because what you find is an elderly couple, and they're running out of money, but they have a beautiful tea service that they were given at their wedding or something like that, and he's happy to buy it for the melt value or some fraction of the melt value, and so there is silver that comes back in, but in general, you're right, most silver gets used, and it's hand to mouth, and there are all kinds of new technologies that are developing need more silver. I mean, and cars need more silver, batteries need more silver, solar needs more silver. In fact, this new Toshiba solid-state battery that they think might really revolutionize car performance.
Very exciting.
Yeah, that needs a ton of silver. So, you can hold a beach ball underwater for a while, and in this case, they've obviously done it for several years, but it's going to break free. And, my target kind of falling off a log silver price is $100 an ounce.
Mm-hmm.
The old high of 50 that the Hunt Brothers established in 2011 echoed. We're going to go through that. I mean, how is it that this is an absolutely necessary, essential commodity that everyone needs and uses, and yet we're not at an all-time high when literally every other commodity in the world has put in all-time highs? I mean, it's stunning to me that they've been able to suppress it so much, but they have. As you point out, the system is not fair, and there's a lot of rigging going on.
If anybody was accidentally making the price go higher, I think by the same mechanisms, I trust the SEC would be all over them by, daybreak,
Maybe.
But so we have very unsound money, and I found something that I thought for sure Larry's going to appreciate this, and maybe one other person in the whole world, but this is fun for me,
okay.
You go to the H41, which is the Federal Reserve has to put out these financial statements, and this is Table 7. It's collateral held against Federal Reserve notes. So this is what backs the Federal Reserve notes. This is how you know that the dollars you hold, Larry, are backed by something. What's the collateral? And they say the collateral is, they have a gold certificate account. By the way, it's funny because they say, the gold certificates are their asset. The Treasury also claims them as an asset. I'll let them duke that out in the courts. Can't be both. But notice what they're saying is collateral is U.S. Treasury agency debt, which is backed by dollars. So they're using dollars to back dollars, and they actually print this table and say, we're good, right?
Yeah, it's pretty ballsy making that. I mean, there's so much alleged demand. I mean, how about the fact that the Federal Reserve is running enormous losses because they've got this low interest rate paying bond portfolio, and they're paying out more in IR, interest on excess reserves, and they're calling that a deferred asset. I'm like, no, it's not. That's a loss.
It's a loss. It's not a deferred asset.
You are subsidizing the banks to the tune of several hundred billion dollars a year, and you're calling it a deferred asset. What? I mean, obviously they're saying that because it's deferred because it holds the system together. But yeah, look, you can't make this shit up, Chris. I mean, you literally just can't make this shit up. And I watch Jay Powell get on his press conferences and say, we're doing things in the best interest of the American people. And I just scream at the TV, liar, liar, liar. I mean, he knows better. He's not stupid. They are screwing us left, right, and center.
The markets are a ticking time bomb. Volatility is spiking. Trade wars have broken out. And most investors are sleepwalking into disaster. Many portfolio strategies perform poorly during times like these. At Peak Financial Investing, however, we don't gamble with your future. Our registered investment advisory connects you with battle-tested wealth managers who reject outdated models and embrace active management, strategies proven to navigate chaos, and who aren't afraid to discuss things like the great taking or maybe the importance of protecting your wealth with gold. Without the right approach and with the wrong advisor, you're risking, well, everything. Don't wait for the crash to act. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com right now to schedule a free consultation and discuss your particular situation. Take control of your wealth before the markets take it from you. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com, and I'm Dr. Chris Martinson urging you to act now. So let's talk about, you know, what people can do to get out of this. Because, you know, obviously real estate taxes are crushing people, insurance costs, inflation, et cetera. It's very hard to stay in front of inflation. Yeah. I think you would probably agree that inflation, as bad as it is understated officially by the official numbers.
Totally.
By some whole number, like two or three.
I mean, and Chapwood Index and John Williams Shadow Government stats and... You know, and it goes from different areas. I mean, sure, one area might be deflating. I mean, you know, eggs came down a lot in price when the chicken thing got sold. But as you point out, you know, your insurance bill is going crazy because all the insurance companies are losing money. So, yeah, inflation, it's hard to measure inflation. But the best long-term measure of inflation is the underlying growth in M2. I mean, that's kind of what I use as the base level. And there are years when reported inflation is lower than that, but that doesn't, you know, that's only a lag. It's going to catch up at some point, right?
There's all of that, by the way. Very surprisingly to me, because I've been a peak oil guy for a long time. Yeah. I'm an oil investor at the individual well level. Listen, you put the hole in the ground, it flows well for a while, and then it dwindles away. It's a thing. This is just geology. But what was surprising was finally in March of this year, the EIA, the Energy Information Agency out of the DOE, said, oh, U.S. oil production peaks in 2027, they said. They've now dialed that back to 2026. Doesn't matter. This should be sending shockwaves,
yeah,
right, through the system, because it's not running out, of course, you know, for anybody listening. It's not that, but it's the days of U.S. being a swing producer and producing whatever it wants are over. And it's going to start going the other direction. It is such an extraordinary thing. We need to have an energy policy that's like written by adults. Yeah. And we just don't yet at this point. You know, we're going to drill, baby, drill, and we're going to export it.
And drill, baby, drill is a good thing. I mean, don't get me wrong. You know, a lot of things, you know, Trump would dealt a shitty hand, and he's trying to do the right things. I mean, deregulating, you know, the additional drilling. I mean, the Doge. I mean, even the fact that Doge kind of failed at a macro, big macro level. I mean, they did discover a lot of fraud in that USAID thing, and they chopped back a lot. So give them their due. They're at least trying to push things in the right direction. You know, I mean, reshoring industry here. I mean, valid thing to do. Great idea. Things we should do, but. You know, the problem is you've got 40 years of rot, and you can't solve 40 years of rot in 4 years, you know, much less in 6 months, you know, that he's been in there. So it's been hard, you know, and it's going to continue to be hard. And these problems are very, very large and somewhat insurmountable until we reset the money to sound money. And that's, you know, I don't want to be all doom and gloom. And some people say, oh, this guy's just some old boomer and he's a doomer. And I'm not at all. I think the world's going to be a much better place in 10, 15, 20 years. But we first got to make our way through this monetary transition, because this system's broken. I mean, I don't think it's anything. I mean, how can you look at the system and not say this is broken? When we got kids in New York City voting for a nefoud socialist Marxist, I mean, it's like, huh? You know, do you guys have any sense of how bad that would be? You know, and you want to turn into Venezuela. So, you know, we'll see. But I mean, we've got to fix this monetary system, Chris. That's the solution.
Well, I confess, I think on this all the time. I can't find a way to solve this current the dollar system, right?
Right.
Because you really only have two options, right? One is you pay the debt down, so that's austerity, politically very unpopular. You know, you have to tell this generation that they have to tighten their belts because the prior generation did some stupid things, overspent, and spent it on things that didn't really add to prosperity so much. So, oops, right? But, you know, so that's unpopular. Or you have to try and inflate it at just a fast enough rate that you don't just blow your whole society up. You don't get into the hyperinflation. It doesn't get away from you in some important way. Those are the only options for that. But alternatively, you know, now we see, I'm a little worried. Want to know what I'm worried about?
What?
I'm worried about watching the stablecoin acts going through, because to me, Larry, those smell like CBDCs by any other name.
Yep.
And that they're going to just try and do the impossible, which is our plane is flying and both wings fell off, and they're going to staple some stablecoin wings on and you know, get this right, I think. But yeah. I don't, barring that, I don't know. I don't think there's a solution to this that doesn't have a lot of pain for people.
No, there really isn't. And as my book argues, I think that the honest and correct way to deal with that pain would be, you know, a complete expose of what we've done wrong, how we got here, what we need to do on a go forward basis, and kind of what I would call a massive global reset, you know, at a lot of levels, almost like a constitutional convention where we say, okay, you know, the founders had these great ideas, and here are the ways that they've been, you know, hijacked since that time. And here's our new proposal. You know, we are going to have term limits. We are going to have a federal, you know, balanced budget amendment. We are going to return to a sound money standard. Returning to a sound money standard, Chris, you're right, would be very painful, because particularly for people who own bonds and certain assets. But my view is it's painful now. You know, this is a rip the Band-Aid off situation. It's like, you know, let's rip the Band-Aid off, go through a very high one-time inflation, but at least know that then going forward, things would be sound. You know, because I've studied a lot of hyperinflation throughout history, and, you know, they're terrible. They wreck societies. They lead to all kinds of bad outcomes. However, the one thing that generally happens on the other side of them is that people are so fed up, they return to some form of sound money. And amazingly, you know, people just want to get up and go to work every day and have a fair shake. And so when you return to sound money, you can do that, and they heal. I mean, take Ecuador in 2000 is a really good example of that. I mean, they were torn apart by hyperinflation, and they reset to a dollar standard, which is not a great currency, but better than the currency they had. And 3 years later, they're booming. So, you know, you can do it. I mean, I'm here to say we can get from here to where we need to be, but it's going to take, you know, visionary leadership. It's going to take voters that say this is what we need and want and demand, because we're tired of this inflation. It's making life unlivable. And the way to get those voters to say that is to have them read my goddamn book. I mean,
yep.
Obviously, I'm trying to sell books here, but, you know, as you know, because I think you've written some books, you don't make a lot of money selling books. You really don't.
No. The most expensive business card I ever wrote. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. I mean, it's the notion, we just got to get this knowledge out to a broader group of people so that, you know, if you know, people say you can't vote your way out of it, I kind of disagree. I mean, I kind of think that if we have a big enough catastrophe and enough people are educated in the right solution, we will come out of this. I maybe, you know, some people call me Pollyanna. Some others say I'm, you know, Don Quixote tilting at windmills, but whatever. I mean, I got to do it. and I think there's a way. I do think there's a way through this, Chris. I really do. But not the way we are right now. I mean, not with the level of knowledge that most people have right now. No, most, you know, because if, I mean, Bessent has said he wants to sit at the next Bretton Woods, but if he were to go out and say, hey, guess what? We're going to back the dollar with gold and Bitcoin. You know, people would go nuts. I mean, there's no way that anyone would understand why he's doing it.
Well, I'd love to get your take on this, because I know that you structured your fund around Bitcoin, gold, but really anti-dollar.
Yes.
If I was going to sort of put it under one umbrella, and this is the dollar since the beginning of the year, it's down. It's going to be 11% now, I guess, ish. Here through this period here, this is the beginning of the year 2025. Dollar's down. Now this is the dollar against other currencies, right? So this is a basket. So this is the USD, mostly against the euro, the yen, stuff like that. Obviously, against gold and Bitcoin, this is a really bad-looking chart. But are you tracking this, and is this are you getting concerned? Tell me about what you see in the dollar chart.
Yeah, so I am, and I follow it very carefully. Keep in mind, though, that it's really the dollar against other fiat currencies. So these are all paper currencies, and they're all destined to fail. Two of them are, you know, the yen the euro are the two biggest ones. And so, you know, it's a problem that you know, right now we're weaker than them, and that someday the yuan will be in there as a bigger currency as well. So, you know, my view is the dollar is important, but it's going to fade against these other currencies, and but they're going to fade too. And so the real cross that I'm always looking at is kind of dollar gold and dollar Bitcoin and dollar silver. You know.
Mm-hmm.
There will come a time, in my view, when the dollar will not be a relevant currency. It'll be a much smaller piece of all transactions, and there'll be, you know, multi-currencies. I mean, what we need is a neutral reserve asset, and gold fills that role very well, and Bitcoin can grow to fill that role, in my opinion. I want to go back to your earlier CBDC comment and stablecoins lurking. And I think there's some risk of that. I think that's somewhat probable. My sense now is that this is so, all this stuff is so far outside of the barn that it's going to be very hard for them to come back and try and do the Elizabeth Warren thing. I do worry, though, that in 4 years, you know, Team Blue might win and they might say, hey, all you sound money people are ruining our beautiful Keynesian system and we're going to 6102 you, you know, and we're going to tax the hell out of gold or tax the hell out of silver or tax the hell out of Bitcoin. I mean, I worry about that. And, you know, the Bernies and the AOCs and the socialist part of this country will claim that all the billionaires got their money unfairly. And, you know, there's, I mean, in the sense that they're quintillionaires, a few of them did, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But it's not capitalism that's broken because we don't really have capitalism. This is crony capitalism. So, yep. You know, and so, you know, the, again, back to first principles, if we could get to sound money, life will get to be much better all the way around. So that's the issue.
Agreed. And you know, our best and brightest got siphoned off to Wall Street financialization, which is defined as making money with money, right?
Right.
And all of that. So if I could wave my magic policy wand, I would just tell Trump, you know, tell all, every regulatory agency, top to bottom, down to the municipal area, you have to lose half your rules. I don't care which half, but you got to take half away right now. Yeah. And by the way, you know, I'm a big fan of Charlie Munger. You know, you show me the incentive, I'll show you the outcome. Yeah. I think if I could wave my magic policy wand, like if the Department of Agriculture says, oh, Chris, you're going to have to burn your beehives because we think there's a risk that there's a mite in there, I'd say, great, you have to pay me for it. It has to come out of their budget. And if they really think it's important, they'll find the money and we're good, right? But instead, they just dictate that I have to, like, you know, lose all this money because they said so. And the incentives are all wrong. So I think we got to get sound money gives us the chance to connect consequences, incentives, and outcomes back again.
Absolutely. It'll fix so many things. And I think that's what people are missing is just how much has gone wrong as a result of the money being unsound. I mean, you know, my book also talks about in great detail. I'm sure you're very familiar with and have thought it through. And, you know, the wars that we conduct, you know, the $8 trillion that we pissed away in the Middle East. I mean, if somebody mm-hmm. come to the American public and said, guys, we want to go fight these wars in the Middle East, and by the way, your taxes are going to go up 30% in order to do so, you know, there would have been a revolution the next day. You know, what the hell? No, I don't give a shit about Iraq. I don't care about Afghanistan. But no, mm-hmm. that's not what they did. They went and conducted the wars, and then they inflated the money away, and then, so they paid for them by, you know, making our grocery bill higher, right? And it's, you know, it's subtle, right? I mean, it's sneaky. But, you know, again, the proper incentives and, you know, maybe they can't conduct the war, right?
Right. So. Right. Well, you know, at the end, you know, sort of like problem definition. But by the end, you're like, look, here's what we need to do. Can you summarize that? Like what should the average person be doing here?
Well, yeah. So what the average person needs to do, and I say it in the book, and I'm not, you know, I'm a RIA, registered investment advisor, but I'm not legally, you know, permitted to make recommendations. So this is just a general blanket recommendation. Everyone's circumstance is different. You decide, do whatever you want. My personal opinion, it's not an investment recommendation, is that if one does not own sound money, if one's savings are not somewhat allocated to sound money, and by somewhat, I mean at least 20%, that one is going to experience regret in the next 10 years, because I think we're in for a decade of very significant inflation as they continue to debase the currency through money printing because of the Stein's Law debt to GDP issue that you and I discussed a moment ago. So, you know, what that means is you start with gold. You know, it's the mama sound money. It's analog sound money. It's been around for 5,000 years. It's less volatile than Bitcoin. You can hold on to it, et cetera. It's the, you know, the long-term superior form of sound money. However, it has less alpha than Bitcoin because it's not undergoing an adoption curve because everyone wants it, has it. If you want to be a little more aggressive on the monetary metals, then silver, which is kind of the whip end of the sound money spectrum, it goes up and down faster because it's a smaller market. And then, of course, I'm a big proponent of Bitcoin because I do believe it is turning into digital gold, and that it will, you know, ultimately, in terms of raw price performance against the dollar, it will outperform gold pretty significantly. And the reason for that is that it's undergoing an adoption curve. And that, you know, right now, 14% of the country knows about it and holds it. I believe that, you know, Gladwell's tipping point issue, you know, in 10 years, another 15 years, a large percentage of the country will hold it. And as you and I both know, there's only a fixed supply of 21 million. I mean, one thing that differentiates Bitcoin and gold is that we do mine gold every year. Not a lot, 1.7% of the outstanding supply. But in 40 years, the world will have twice as much gold above ground as it has today. In 40 years, there'll still only be 21 million Bitcoin. So, you know, that fact, in my opinion, makes Bitcoin more attractive in terms of generating alpha than gold. But the price of that alpha is that we've seen multiple 70% drawdowns, and people cannot forget that. And so when I see Bitcoiners telling people, oh, yeah, just put all your money in Bitcoin, no problem, borrow money, go to Bitcoin, et cetera, I'm like, whoa, slow down. You got to explain to people what they're buying and what can happen so that they don't make the terrible mistake that I know some people made of buying it at 60 before Sam Bankman-Fried, and then, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried blows up and crypto blows up and Powell jacks rates and it goes from 50 down to 15. And they think, oh, I made a mistake, and they blow it out, which is the wrong thing to do. If they'd hung on to it, they'd, you know, bought it at 50 and now it'd be at 109. But, you know, obviously that roller coaster was tough for some people to ride. So I think it's important people understand what they're buying when they do buy Bitcoin. And I always, when I'm looking at people's allocation to Bitcoin, I always try to say to them, think about what you'd be willing to see go down 50%. And your thought pattern, if that happened, would be, oh, I'll buy some more, rather than, oh, I made a mistake and I'm going to sell this. So that, I think it's important for people to understand that volatility in Bitcoin. But I, you know, as I say to my clients, many of whom are gold people, many of whom are very resistant to it, I've said to them, look, the only wrong allocation is zero. You know, I don't care if you buy 2%. I think this thing can go up 10x and then go up 10x again. And if you have zero in 10 or 15 years, you might experience regret. But if you have 2%, it goes up 10x, well, that becomes 20% of your portfolio. And then it goes up 10x again, that gives you 200% of your portfolio. So, you know, maybe you want to buy 2%. Most people can afford to lose 2% of their savings if they're wrong. So that's kind of how I view Bitcoin.
Oh, I love that. And by the way, I had a fabulous moment this year where a good longtime friend of mine, I finally got him and he started going into gold and silver. Then he really went in and, but you know, gold would go up, silver would go down. He'd be calling. And then eventually I got the call and he said, hey, so my house went up 40% over the last 5 years in Phoenix. But when I measured how many ounces of gold it would have took in 2017 versus today, it's the same number. So now we're just talking, we don't do the dollar stuff anymore. We're just like, how many ounces do you have? How many sats do you got? Right? It's just like that's the decoupling. Like, you no longer measure in dollars, right? Because it looks like his house went up 40% in value. It didn't. It's the exact, it was literally within a tenth of an ounce, the same number. Yeah. Across those two time frames.
Measured in Bitcoin terms, it probably got cheaper in Bitcoin.
It did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, some people say, well, Bitcoin's too volatile to be money. And I flipped that on its head. I said, no, the dollar's too volatile to be money. Bitcoin, one Bitcoin equals one Bitcoin. That damn dollar price keeps going up and down a lot.
Well, I mean, it's fundamentally impossible to have a stable, sound, honest system on a fraudulent system of money.
Correct.
It's the frauds. The fraud is right in its very construction.
Correct.
Right? Where some people get to decide and print it and hand it to their friends. And the rest of us have to work for it and take risks with it.
Yeah, I mean, Jack Mahler said it right. It's wrong for any man to be able to print money, you know, in exchange for me to labor for money that some man can print. You know, it's just fundamentally wrong. And so,
indeed.
Yeah, it. And some of us have known this for a long, long time, Chris. I mean, I know you're one of them. I'm one of them. We were reading Russell in the 70s. I mean, you know, I mean, my grandfather was outraged in 71 when we went off the gold standard. I mean, some of us have known this for a long time, and it's taken a lot of years for these chickens to come home to roost. But, you know, here we are 50 plus years later, and boy, they, you know, they appear to be coming in big time because, you know, it's, you know, what is this Hemingway's, you know, suddenly, you know, gradually and then suddenly. It appears like we're entering the suddenly phase.
Yeah, I have a model for that. It's about how exponential functions work. But yes, we are in the suddenly phase. So buckle up, people. You will have regrets if you're not in sound money. Lots of ways to skin that cat, as Larry's been telling us. The book is The Big Print. Larry Lepard, you are at Lawrence Lepard on Twitter. Where else? Anywhere else?
That's it. I have a website, EMA2.com, which is my fund, Edward Mark Alpha, the number 2.com. We do a free quarterly newsletter. We'll never spam you. At the bottom of that site, you can input your email address. It'll just automatically get added to the list. So every quarter, I kind of reflect on what's going on in the macro world and how it affects gold and silver and Bitcoin. So that's for free. And yeah, I make a lot of noise on Twitter. I'm not very friendly to the central banks. I think the central banks are a plague on humanity. I really do. But I think we need to get more people to understand that, and we need to, Ron Paul had it right all those years ago when he said we got to end the Fed. We really do. Having them as a cartel to set the price of money is just fundamentally wrong. It just does not work. And that's what's caused all this pain. And you look at all this political dysfunction. I mean, even within families, you see families, team blue and team blue and team red are fighting. I mean, none of this wasn't going on when I was a kid or when you were a kid. It was just mm-hmm. It was a more civil country. And it's become uncivil because everybody's hurting. And the reason they're hurting is because the monetary system's broken. So if we go back, my tagline on Twitter is, if we fix the money, we fix the world. And I really sincerely believe that.
Yeah, let's end the Fed. Let's get this done.
Yeah, I mean, huge respect for all that you've done and with your pods and your newsletter and everything else. I've been a longtime fan and follower. And I mean, your covering of the whole medical side of this fraud has just been outstanding. And I really, huge props to you for all the work you've done on that. So thank you for having me on your show.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that too. All right, Larry, we'll do this again sometime.
Absolutely.
Until next time. All right, everybody, this has been a Finance U episode, and thank you very much for listening again. Remember, if you want to find out more, you can follow us at peakfinancialinvesting.com and or come back over to Peak Prosperity. Those are my two operations. All right, until next time. Bye, everyone.